Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? Welcome to another episode of The Command Zone. I'm your host, Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
And we're very high-spirited today because it's a fun one.
Because this is our third attempt at starting the podcast.
Yes. Yeah, you guys don't hear the 50,000 times we do this beforehand when it just ends up in us saying the wrong thing.
Or just making a joke and the other guy laughing.
Yeah. There's a lot of mistakes, but...
What are you talking about? We're perfect.
Yeah, that's right. I've never made a single mistake on this podcast ever. As I continue to barrel through and make more rules mistakes, and I don't know how trample works, I guess. All right. So today's episode.
That's the ongoing joke.
Yeah.
How does trample work again?
I don't know. I think you hit him and then you hit him some more.
Yeah.
So it's like double strike, essentially.
I think it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. Team or Battle Rage really gives me a headache. And.
How can it have trample and double strike when they do the same thing?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Redundant. Okay, so today's topic is called trading up. Josh provided the mana base topic last week, so I wrote this one up. It's about making the best out of your cards and your resources in acquiring and trading them. But before we get to that, we have a few things that we'd like to talk about on air. The first is a very sad goodbye to the Five Commanders podcast. They posted on their website that they are going to no longer be recording under the banner of the Five Commanders. However, they are still interacting with all of you guys on Facebook, Twitter, and email, which they're monitoring daily. So I'm super excited because they have some possible updates regarding future ventures. But I'm also sad because the podcast is going to be on a temporary hiatus.
Yeah, it is pretty sad. Phil and Casey are guys we got to know. We got to play once with Brenton. I think you played with a couple of the other guys. Mm-hmm. Really cool guys. I was a fan of their show. We had just encouraged all our listeners to listen to them, and then
Well, they have an excellent backlog. I will guarantee you that much. They've had Sheldon on a couple of times as well. They actually introduced Sheldon to us. Thank you very much, guys, for that during the whole Great Tuck debate of 2015.
That was so long ago.
Yeah, it was like
actually like two weeks ago.
No, Dragon Week felt like 5 weeks in a row. I was doing so much tweeting. Oh my gosh.
Anyway, so yeah, we're sad to see those guys go, and wish them the best in future endeavors. We're excited to, you know, they're going to be coming out with hopefully some more Magic content, and so I'm excited to hear it.
Yeah, and hopefully we get to play with them again soon because there were some memorable games in there.
Another thing we wanted to say is iTunes reviews. One of our listeners brought this up in the comment section recently, and we used to ask you guys to go to iTunes and give us reviews, and then we stopped asking that, and people stopped giving us reviews, and so all our reviews are from, like, January. And so, hey, we'd like to encourage you to go to the reviews on iTunes and give us a review. It really does help us out in the same way that following us on Twitter and all those other social media things do, so, yeah.
Yeah, we want to look as spick and span as possible for the big daddy Wizards of the Coast.
Yep, it helps us get product from them to pass on to you guys. It also just helps us promote the show, get big guests on. Mm-hmm. It's just good for everybody. So if you can take the time to do that, that would really be awesome.
Yeah, and any excuse I get to hang out with my friends that do work at the company is the better because it's great. I love everyone that I know that works at that company is a superbly nice person and is genuinely here to do the same thing that we're trying to do, which is have you love a game that they make.
Yeah, they are really cool people. So
yeah, it's a pretty cool job. It's kind of a dream. It was probably one of my dream jobs growing up was to work at Wizards.
Work at Wizards?
Yeah, we grew up with Wizards or Bungie. Yeah, like all these awesome gaming companies are all around you. And it's pretty sweet.
My dream was to work in the movie business.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I think you made it there.
I wish my dream was to work at Wizards or something else. Do I sound jaded? Sorry.
Hey, welcome to show business.
It's not show friends.
That's right. Well, we're definitely doing business out here because today's topic is a lot about that. So the idea of trading up in a game of Magic means that you are there's something beneficial happening where you trade a card for someone else's or you two for one then, which means you get two cards of value for their one card.
A lot of times trading up is also like if my card that costs less mana than your card trades for your card. So then I'm up some tempo on you. So if my 2-drop trades for your 4-drop, that's actually advantageous to me. It's not quite as good as getting a 2-for-1 card-wise, but if I keep doing that in the long haul over the course of a game, I'm gonna have extra mana above you, and I might be able to do more things than you. So
and you should be winning because you've done more advantageous things for you.
I mean, if my 2-drop trades for your 4-drop, then I play my 4-drop.
Yeah.
Like, where are we at? I'm ahead there.
You definitely are. Yeah. Because you may play a 3-drop in the middle. I think the best example that's really easy to see is like a Death Touch Rats.
Yes.
They sit there, they're a 1-1 for 1 black mana, and they drop a 5/5/5 mana green elk. And you're like, my rats will bite it, and they both die.
They bit Elmer?
They bit Elmer.
Yeah. How dare they?
Yeah, sorry, Marshall. But rats are, they'll get you. Okay,
you dirty rat.
Trading up outside of the game means how do you acquire cards, how do you trade your cards for better cards, and also what cards you take in your deck and literally take out and put in to trade up the card and upgrade it in a certain way. So we're trying to find value in cards that have made way out of your decks as well, and there's a lot of steps along, so we're going to talk about the life of a card to make our way there. So the first thing that happens with a card is it's born anywhere. So it could have been made in Alpha, or it could have been spoiled in Dragon's Darkir, but it has to come from someone. And what's different is usually how you hear about it. So you'll get it played against you, you'll have a friend recommend it, you'll hear it on a podcast like ours, or you'll find it through Gatherer.
Or you're going through the spoiler and it's
exactly.
It hasn't come out yet, but it's about to.
Yeah, you're getting super excited to get this card because you see it and it's like, this card needs to be in this deck, or I think there is something here.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of you guys that have just bought like pre-constructed commander decks, this is probably something that you immediately started thinking about. So as soon as you start fanning through the cards and being like, oh, this political one, I don't know if I like the effects of this one as much as some other card that I've seen.
It's why pre-cons are very good when you're starting out too, because they basically just give you a whole bunch of cards that maybe you haven't seen, and that's a good starting point,
mm-hmm.
you know, to see cards you wouldn't have seen and to start, you know, start those synapses?
Synergies?
Synapses firing?
Your synapses firing, yeah.
Synapses, not
your
synapses.
Your synapses define the synergies.
Yes,
so there's
exactly.
A lot going on.
So just start those brain pistons firing.
Yeah.
Brain pistons.
I bet
good.
If you bought, it'd be a cool experiment to do if you bought all 5 of the colored pre-constructed decks from this last year and see what kind of multicolored decks you can make out of it. And you'll get the commanders from somewhere else, but see if you can blend those cards together in a way to make them work. There are some cards you won't be able to use as well, like the medallions and stuff, but...
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely do it. Anytime you get a certain amount of magic cards, you know, in a pile, you're going to find all kinds of synergies that you never would have known existed.
Yeah, and that's part of the fun.
Yeah.
So the first main point today is determining which cards are coming out of your deck, and we could spend a whole episode on just this alone.
We did a little bit. There's a Gaddock Teague episode with Alex Kessler from the Masters of Modern. We talked about cutting cards.
Right.
But we didn't go super deep on it. You're right. This is probably a full topic, but we can touch on it here.
Yeah. So cutting cards is definitely, I think, one of the more difficult things that can happen, especially right after you've built the deck and you're like, all right, I have 130 cards. Like, how do I get this down to 100? Because you look at each card and you have to make a decision. Like, how do I get rid of this card? I like it so much, or I've never played it before. The first main thing is just play test. So the next time you play, always be taking mental notes. I find it just to be really helpful just to see something and be like, all right, I'm going to stick that in a segment of my brain I'll think about later. Like, if you have a card in your
I even will keep my phone out.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
And I'll just keep the notepad on my phone, and there'll be cards people play that I haven't seen, and I'll write those down, and then there'll be cards in my hand or cards in the game that just don't work the way that I want them to.
Yeah.
And I'll make notes in the notepad on my phone so that later, a couple days later, it's often hard to remember, like, exactly... what was that card again that I didn't like having in my hand? And if you didn't write it down at the time, you might not remember. But then, you know.
Writing
and how
down
often
is
do you
very helpful.
Put a card in your deck and you're like, I thought it was going to do this, but I read it wrong. Or, you know what I mean? And then you can play 3 or 4 games before you you might not even draw it in all the games. So it can take a while to cycle that out of your deck if you don't write it down.
Yeah. And one of the easiest ways to tell is also, like, if it's in your opening hand and you're considering a mulligan just based on the hand itself, like, how much does that single card affect your decision? And you'll find that, you know, some cards will be better in the early game, of course, and will weigh you towards that certain way. But if it's like an Insurrection on turn 1 and you're like, well, I tried playing Insurrection last time and someone just countered it because I had 8 mana up and, you know, I was clearly holding a couple cards in my hand. And they know that I can do that. So, like, think about that and think about how it affects your decision there. Something that Josh mentioned was that, like, what does the card do? And if you have too much redundancy for an effect, to not go overboard on that. And that's actually something that's interesting because it's sort of paring down from the opposite direction.
Yeah, I, you know, a lot of decks, like, let's say the Marquesa deck that I've talked about a few times. Marquesa wants to put a bunch of 1-1 counters on your creatures. And so you end up putting in a bunch of stuff that puts 1-1 counters on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's entirely possible to have too much of that in your deck so that your deck's not doing anything else. And then, you know, you don't have sack outlets, or you don't have enough card draw, or you don't have enough ramp. And the balance of that can be where when you initially build your deck, which is what I did, I'm like, oh, I don't have any problem putting 1/1 counters on anything. I have way too much of that.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of decks have a specific thing they're doing. Maybe it's graveyard synergy. Maybe it's, you know, card draw. Maybe it's
every deck should just be about card draw.
Yeah, but Nekusar can have too much card draw.
Right.
To the point where it doesn't have enough of the other stuff, and you end up being like, I don't have trouble making people draw cards. I have trouble killing all the creatures on the board or something like that. So that's another thing where it's like you can have too much redundancy.
Yeah, definitely. And that's like, again, like if you see it in your hand and you're going, oh, another one of these, I much would have rather had one of these instead. Right. That's a clear sign you might need to get rid of a card. And sort of what we were saying is like, go back to the basics. Like, what was the original idea for the deck? Because every deck starts from somewhere. Like, where did you start with the deck? And are you still with that original like premise or like your thesis statement of the deck? And
I don't do this enough.
Yeah.
Or I stubbornly stick to what my original thesis was for the deck was. And then I'm like, boy, I really should go in this other direction.
Yeah.
You know, that's the stuff that's working really good. But you just sort of have this initial idea in your head. And for whatever reason,
that's the Johnny in you.
Yeah. You don't stay there. Yeah. And I hang on to that for too long sometimes. You don't do that.
No, but it is good to hang on to it if you do it, because comboing off is fun and hilarious. Like, you're doing something. That's what you built the deck to do, and once you get to do it, it's pretty fun and sweet. But a lot of times deck ideas do evolve, and like your Marchesa deck, Marchesa turned quickly from one into the other, and then finally just became five color. Like, we all knew it was going there, by the way.
Well, not quickly, though. That was one of those decks where I built it, and I had an idea for what it was. And that idea didn't actually work that good.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to admit that. I think you would have taken a lot less time to admit that. And
it's true. I do. I'm just like,
it took me probably 7 months to admit it, you know, playing the deck 25, 30 times.
Well, I noticed you just stopped playing it after a certain time.
And that's when I knew, you know, after it sort of gave me that distance I needed to not care as much about changing it. But if you're playing it all the time, then you're like, but I'd have to take out this card, which I really like, and that card, which I really like. And then I don't play with it for a month or two, and then I don't have any emotional attachment to it, and it's a lot easier for me to change. I mean,
that's very true.
Yeah.
So if your deck is actually in that transitional period where it's sort of stuck between the old mechanics that you liked and the new ones that you're like, wow, I really want to put Delve in this deck, so I'm going to try and enable Delve. Like, you know, if you're stuck in that weird middle area, you need to figure out which cards aren't contributing to where you want to go with the deck. Because you don't need to be so tightly focused, like Josh said, that you're only putting +1/+1 counters on creatures, but you also want to have, you know, you don't want to not go far enough. So find where that balance is and find out what cards fit and don't fit.
One thing I like to do when I'm tuning a deck is I like to make big sweeping, play it twice, and then not just take out two or three cards that add +1/+1 counters. Take out half of them and put in half of something else and then see how that plays. That'll give me a lot better idea of, do I need a lot of this effect or not, than if I just sort of slowly take it down.
Yeah, that's true.
I can overshoot it. And then I can come back to the middle. It's a little bit easier.
Yeah, they kind of say that with like acting and performance too in general. It's better to go too big, and that way you know where to take it down to, instead of you're not there yet and you're afraid to push the boundaries or whatever.
Yeah, there's a, I don't remember where I heard this, but there's a thing in the military where if you're learning to fire a weapon, if you miss short, then your next shot, you better miss long. You know, that's the best way to find the target. If you just slowly tick up, it's going to take you a lot longer.
Yeah, and you're not correctly like figuring. It's sort of, it
you
takes
just won't
like
learn as much on the second shot if you miss short again.
Yeah,
you'll learn a lot more by missing far.
Man, they are min-maxing like crazy.
Well, I mean, you know, their lives are kind of on the line.
Yeah, it's true. Very, very true. One last thing about going back to the basics is like, and this kind of goes into.
Oh, I think
the
I heard that
part.
On Rosewater's podcast.
Amaro's?
Yeah, oh, I think so. Interesting. I'm like, I heard that somewhere. And it was really good explanation, and I'd never put it to words before. But anyway,
that, though, because it definitely applies to a lot of just stuff in life in general, which is nice.
I'd say in all games, like let's say you're playing basketball.
Oh, yeah.
If you're shooting a free throw and you miss it short, miss the next one long.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Just make sure you don't miss it short again.
And fortunately, no one's life is on the line in that case. It's just the basketball and the hoop. So the last sort of mini segment here is separate emotional attachment. And by that, I mean like ask yourself the questions that you don't want to answer.
I don't like this section.
We've all been here. It's a sad, sad place to be, but sometimes that pet card just don't fit and it's too flashy or too big or an old favorite or just sort of like a, you know, it just doesn't serve the purpose that it needs to, and it kind of is just taking up weight just because you're attached to it for a good reason.
Yeah.
This kind of goes into our deck tech for next
episode,
too. You're
100% right, and I don't do this very well. I will, I'm playing blue. I'm putting Fate Stitcher in there, even though it has nothing to do with anything the deck wants to do. But that I just love that card. I'm just putting it in. I feel good every time that card's on the table. So. Yeah. But you're right. There's been times where I'm like, yeah, that Fate Stitcher, it has to come out.
Because it's just not doing
anything. I need
something
that synergizes. Yeah.
Fate Stitcher kind of synergizes with everything.
Well, it's maybe a bad example because it does always
ramp
you.
It's kind of the perfect card. And to me, it's like one of the best EDH cards there is. Like him and the Prophet, they're up there of just like the, you can never go wrong.
Yeah. I mean, even the Prophet is less versatile by far.
Right.
She doesn't do anything if she's the only thing that's out there and you don't have any cards in your hand. Yeah. Fate Stitcher's still good in that scenario.
And he's good
at least
in the graveyard.
Can,
oh, gosh.
Yeah. So, anyway, maybe that's a bad example, but there are other cards. Swan Song's one, which I really do try to jam in, but it's not always, you know. A lot of times there's better cards.
And it's not like a bad thing if the deck goes out. The other thing is like the cards could still very well be viable in another deck.
Right.
You know, it could be a perfect card for a whole nother deck, but it just is not going to fit that archetype that you're trying to do. And when you're trying to refine a deck and sort of twiddle with it and sort of iron out the rough spots, these are the cards that I think are the first ones that don't get sort of automatically put down. It's like, oh, maybe I should take this out. They're like, oh, of course I'm not going to take that out. Sort of just immediately goes back into the keep pile. Just like take a second and look at it and be like, why am I keeping this? Ask yourself the question you don't want to answer.
I think Kessler said on our earlier episode, and this was really interesting, I thought smart, was like, if you're ever down to a point where you're trying to cut like one of three cards and you've got it narrowed down and it's one of these three cards, mm-hmm. and one of those three cards is your pet favorite card, it's probably the one you should cut.
Yeah.
Because it's getting slightly extra points by being just your favorite.
Yeah, maybe it should have been down to two cards.
Yeah, so it probably isn't actually as good as those other two cards.
Yeah, it's true.
So...
Again, like back to the title of this episode, think about it as trading up because you're taking the card that you may even be replacing it for like a mana rock, honestly.
Yeah.
Like it's not going to be as combo-y or flashy, but you probably needed it way more and it's going to make you happier. We talked about this last time. There's no point in playing a game if your mana is not fixed and you can't play the spells in your hand.
I mean, honestly, I would estimate that somewhere around 70% of all my deck tuning involves adding mana ramp and card draw cards and taking out the cool synergy stuff that is the actual theme of the deck.
Yeah, but you keep the right pieces in there so you could still do it. You just have to find the balance.
I mean, when you first build your deck, you put in tons of the cool synergy stuff because that's why you're building the deck. You don't go to build a deck and go like, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to put mana ramp and card draw in there.
Well, some people do.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I love mana ramp and card draw, but it's the cool interactions between your cards that make you want to build the deck.
And your commander specifically.
And the mana ramp and the card draw just make it, this smooth it all out.
Yeah.
And so what happens is you put tons of the cool synergy in, but your game's not smooth because you don't have those basic foundation pieces of mana ramp and card draw.
Yep. You need them. All right, now that you've got space in your deck and you know the sweet card you need to replace it with, you might think, hey, I should just go out and purchase this card because Replenish is the best sorcery ever in white for enchantments. And then you're like, hold up.
Replenish is pretty quick, pretty sweet.
It is pretty expensive, too.
It is.
So we're going to have a short, brief aside and talk about proxying.
Right.
And this is something you guys asked us a lot about, actually. And there's a lot of, I guess it's controversy, but there's a lot of discussion about it.
There's a lot of different opinions.
Yeah, there's a lot of opinions about proxying. Do you want to go first?
Sure. My opinion on proxying is that it's all about how long that card's going to be in your deck. So I'm not in favor of proxying if it's permanent. So, I'm not a big fan of
it. Permanent,
yeah,
right?
Then it's just counterfeit. So, what I would say is I'm perfectly fine with proxying something where, you know, let's say that you're like, well, Sneak Attack might be really good in this deck, but I'm not sure. By the way, Sneak Attack will be good.
Yeah.
That's a bad example, but, you know,
we're all about giving bad examples today.
Some expensive card that you're not 100% sure how good it'll be. Maybe like Avacyn.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pretty expensive card, and you don't want to go buy it.
That's a good idea. Yeah, it's a good example.
You don't want to go buy it, put it in, find out it's not really what the deck needs, and then you just wasted $30. So in that instance, I think it's fine to proxy it and to try it out a few times, and then go, yeah, that did work, and then go buy it. You know, because I totally get it. Like, it's an expensive hobby, so you don't want to be going in and spending a bunch of money that you don't need to. and find out the card doesn't work, and then it's like you spend a bunch of money and it's just sitting there.
Yeah, and it's also like sometimes like, well, do I want to spend $30 on this one card that has a big effect, or five cards that are $6 that, you know, maybe better, like, but sometimes that card is worth it. Like if you're playing a Kalia deck, there should be an Avacyn in there.
Yes.
Like that is the best card for her to pop out. So yeah, I'm in favor of proxying as well. Like, you know, it's obviously not quote unquote counterfeit if it's just a post-it note slammed into a card sleeve, but it is jank. After, like, if it's like a year later and you still got that sucker in there, it's like, all right, well, it doesn't actually feel like I'm playing the same game, if that makes sense.
It feels unfair. It doesn't feel good for your opponents. You know, it's fine if you mention it at the start of the game and you're like, hey, I'm trying out a couple cards.
Oh, yeah, I'm totally fine.
Then I'm totally fine with it. But if the guy's playing that same thing every time, then it gets a little like, it's not fair. Like, why am I not
just... why am I not jamming Mana Crypt in every one of my decks?
Yeah, I'm just going to put Show and Tell and Sneak Attack and all this really expensive stuff. I'm just going to, you know, use a Sharpie and make those cards. Like, that, it can get really degenerate in your playgroup if that's the mentality.
And so, I think that's actually against the spirit of the game, which is we're all co-collecting as hobbyists to play this game together. And, you know, like, every group has their own, like, oh, it was the arms race. Everyone started doing this and this and this and that. But, you know, it really is just about not, you know, I think it's just kind of like, if you really want the card, then it's something that you can find your way to getting. Unless it is like a Black Lotus, then that's...
But we can't play it, so that's not, you know, it doesn't matter for our format. I mean, it's the same theory behind like test driving or trying on clothes before you buy them or things like that. And I think...
Yeah, you wouldn't just go to clothing stores and just try on stuff.
Oh, those jeans are going to fit fine, what? Like, no one would do that. Yeah,
you want to try it on first.
You try it on, make sure that it looks good, make sure that it fits.
Now,
I'm
don't
totally
stay
fine
at the store
that.
And only wear their clothing. See, that's like a proxying for too long. You're just constantly at Abercrombie & Fitch being like, I need more jeans that are faded.
And have, and distressed.
Super distressed. What are they distressed about?
They have, like, paint on them for some reason. Yeah. No, I'm not a painter.
It's like manufacturing defect, but they're like, this is perfect.
Yeah.
All right.
I paid $50 extra for this paint. Welcome to LA.
A couple of nice splotches here and there go a long way. Yeah. So
as I sit here in my distressed jeans,
now that you've finished potentially proxying the card, you know that you want this sucker in your deck. It's time to talk about our second main point, which is best purchasing procedures, or how to buy cards the right way. Because I'm not gonna lie, there are a lot of people selling cards, and in general, a lot of people selling stuff in the real world. And if you are always buying stuff that is too expensive or overpriced and you're not realizing it, then you are going to not have money in your life. You're not going to be able to support yourself.
I mean, the game of Magic is about efficiency, optimization, min-maxing, you know, finding little edges. So Magic's players like to do that. You know, you want to do it in real life too. It's, even if you have tons of disposable income, you still don't want to get ripped off. You still want to get the card you want for the cheapest price possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what this whole section is about. And so there are a lot of options when it comes to getting cards. The first thing you need to ask yourself is, do you need one of this card or like three or four? So sometimes it is like, I need four Command Towers. I need three Sol Rings because I have decks that don't have them yet. And that actually changes how you buy stuff because you can find different deals based on different prices. So you've got
vendors. And also shipping.
Oh, right.
A lot shipping, of there's shipping thresholds for a lot of things. So a lot of times you're just better off buying a few just to get above, you know, get
the above $30 ships free or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. If you're at a certain amount, then pay attention to the shipping threshold. And a lot of times it's like, well, this last thing I'm going to buy is virtually free because it gets rid of the shipping cost.
Yeah.
In which case you should do that.
So you guys have probably heard of a lot of these websites already. So the main way to get cards these days is, I think, online. TCG Player is, I think, kind of at the top of it because they aggregate a lot of stores.
Yeah.
And they
and it's a marketplace, so they have to compete with one another.
Yeah, so you're going to always find competitive pricing. And each store wants your business, so they're putting their best prices out there. And we've also got stuff like Card Kingdom, which used to be the sponsor for LR. You also have MTG Deals, which is next door to here. And you've got lots of websites to do
Star
it on.
City, Star City, Games, Channel Fireball, those are big ones. I would say that in general, buying from those sites like Card Kingdom, MTG Deals, Channel Fireball, Star City, not as good as TCG Player because I think Jason Alt said this when he was on our podcast, but if you're on Star City's website, Star City doesn't have to compete with itself, so there's nothing naturally driving their price down. But on TCG, like, I post my, you know, show and tell for X amount. And then some other guy comes along, looks at it and goes, well, I'll sell mine for cheaper. So there's a natural competition. Yeah. You know, there's natural capitalism that occurs there.
I agree. You're definitely going to find, I think, in general, the best deals on TCG Player. But that's not to say that the other sites don't have their merits, because they have the power, in this case, instead, to be like, we have a winter holiday sale.
Yes.
We are going to be selling these boxes. Like, you know, you can't find product like that and stuff, too. So there's always ups and downs to everything. And I just encourage you to just... you know, check out the websites. We'll have a nice list in the description as well for this podcast.
That's a really good point. A lot of those major websites will have like sale of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll have one card where they've drastically marked it down just for that day or for that week.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a really great way to get cheap cards.
Yeah, it's a good way. And sometimes they'll be like 60% of what the card normally goes for.
Yeah.
And they just have a glut of them or whatever. They're just trying to drive sales to their website. Mm-hmm. You know, Best Buy was famous for this strategy where it would actually sell. They actually put a lot of brick and mortar like music shops out of business by selling CDs and music for cheaper than cost.
Because oh, wow. Best Buy's, just to bring them in.
Yeah, Best Buy's philosophy was, if you come here to buy a CD and we lose a dollar on it, that's actually, but you might buy a washing machine, which will make $200
right.
on it.
Right.
And so that was actually advertising. That was part of an advertising cost, was that's just really losing a dollar on music CDs. But the outcome was Tower Records goes out of business, you know, which kind of sucks. But anyway, the moral of that story is that Channel Fireball or Star City Games, the really big mm-hmm. retailers online, will sometimes do things similar to that, and you can really take advantage.
Yeah, it's not going to put anyone out of business. Trust me, there's a lot of people that want to buy cards, so don't worry about that. Another option online is eBay, and this is actually the one that has the highest variance in terms of pricing, because I think on eBay, you sometimes can get away with complete steals.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I recently got a Mikaias the Unhallowed for probably 50% of the price, and this is after shipping, just because sometimes there'll be auctions up, and it's a whole... There are people that love to just sit there and snipe and find these auctions and go auction hunting. It's actually kind of like gambling in a way. It's what it feels for like.
I think eBay too, like, rewards you like for the work you're doing, and mm-hmm. the work is sifting through like tons of auctions.
Yeah.
So you can turn, like, if you don't have as much money, but you have a little extra time, mm-hmm. then you can turn that time into savings. So that's a good way, I'd say, if you have more time.
Yeah. And in general, you'll find people selling groups of things that you would never find at other websites. Like, this is my my standard collection. I'm offloading it all at once. And the total cost of everything might be like $500, but it sells for $250. Now, of course, if you don't want to get into standard, you shouldn't be purchasing this auction. And for EDH players, I don't think it's a very wise buy either. But it's the kind of thing where you can find an edge and get good deals in random places. And buying four ofs and stuff as well.
Oh, one thing I will say about TCG Player and the big boxes, just to go back to that for a second, is a lot of times you'll buy some stuff from TCG Player, it'll get sent to you,
mm-hmm.
and then the store that sent it to you will give you like a little coupon.
Right, $5 off.
Or 10% off if you order directly from us, mm-hmm. and things like that. And so that can be a boon. Card Kingdom, I know, does this. Channel Fireball and Star City, I think, do, which is if you sell cards to them.
Oh, right.
Then you can get an additional percentage if you use that for store credit. So a lot of them have a buy list, and it'll say, like, we want Bremaz, and we're paying $18 for Bremaz. And you go, okay, I'm going to send you three Bremaz, and I'm going to get $54.
Yeah.
But if you take that in store credit, they'll give you an additional 30%. So now all of a sudden you've got $70.
Yeah. It's great for you if you want to get more cards, and it's even better for them because you're essentially giving them everything. You're giving them a card and the money that you made from it back right back into the system. So
yeah, so everybody's happy in that scenario. So mm-hmm. I would look out for little edges like that, because they can be advantageous.
You can also get cards at GPs or events, or of course your LGS.
I would say GPs are usually a bad place, because everyone in although for EDH, it's not bad.
EDH is not bad, yeah. If you're trying to find the hot card that everyone's trying to spec on, like a Siege Rounder right before a standard GP, is not going to be the
like
right place to
get
it.
Three times more than it should be.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're finding some EDH staple that isn't even legal in standard, and it's mm-hmm. a standard GP, then you can maybe find good deals on it.
Yeah, a lot of these people come to the GPs, and they're just vendors, and they have huge little cases of stuff, and a lot of it has nothing to do. A lot of they're like, hey, check out all these foil unhinged islands I have.
Right.
You know? And they're very amicable to, I think, making deals as well in these situations. I mean, like, hey, if you want to buy this and this, you know, maybe I can cut you a small deal here, or if you want to trade with me, et cetera. So it's much more social in that aspect. And it's the same for your LGS. Probably your best same-day resource. It's like the most reliable one where you can go to and on the same day get something if you need it. And I encourage this beyond everything else, because supporting your local game store is like it's your home away from home. You know, it's a very important place for a lot of players that want to compete in events or even just have a place to play Commander with their friends because they don't have the table space or, you know, their mom kicked them out.
Did this happen to you, Jimmy?
No, it didn't happen to me.
The thing about the LGS is it also fosters your community.
Yeah.
Like you want people playing the game in your community because that gives you people to play with and against. And yeah. It gives you enough. If you have to hit this tipping point where there's enough players to organize things like tournaments and pre-TQs and PTQs and, you know, Friday Night Magics and all this, these events that you want to happen, because the way that you help that happen is you help your LGS be strong and you help it grow, and it'll continue to grow your community. So supporting your LGS is, there's a lot of benefits besides just having a store that you can buy cards from right across the street.
Yeah. This is also the place that you're going to meet a friend that will trade with you. And that is, of course, the other best purchasing procedure that costs no money. You just trade for a card instead, and you don't have to, you know, it's kind of like the thing where you're trading back into Channel Fireball or whatever. You're actually giving someone something that's not money, and you get another card back in return.
And the thing about trading is it's a one-to-one process. Now, buying or selling your cards to a store or a retailer is, you're always going to lose a little bit of equity because they need a profit margin.
Right.
But when I'm just trading with you, we can just be equal. So that can just be a one-to-one, dollar-for-dollar, straight-across trade.
Yeah.
You rarely get that at a store.
That's true. All right. So I would say always ask a friend first. You'll probably find a way to get the card you want if someone has it without paying money. That's definitely the best way to save money, is just to look for that. And then, you know, check out your options online. And when you go to buy the card, you want to save as much money as possible. So if you're getting into this game and you're investing in it, it's going to be something you're probably going to do more times down the line. So just set good guidelines for yourself. Like, a penny saved is truly a penny earned. And like, TCG Player has this cool thing called the Cart Maximizer, where they'll try and find you the best
optimizer.
Price. Optimizer, right. And they'll like do like this like looking thing, and they'll find the best stores and try and group your shipments together, and, you know, maybe give you a lightly played instead of near mint to save you some dollars here and there. And
yeah, you have to play with the options, especially if you have foils or if you're worried about the condition of the cards. But the optimizer is amazing. You'll pick all these cards you want, and then you'll hit optimize, and all of a sudden, like, they'll, yeah, like you said, they'll group them together so the shipping's less, and you can save, like, you know,
sometimes like up to $20-$30 on the
sometimes
shipment.
It'll be like 15% or something,
Which is cool. And also, of course, if you go to your LGS, they also want to keep you as a customer. So while they do have a profit margin, it's in their best interest to not scam you out of your cards and to give you a good trade-in deal or whatever, because that means that you're going to keep going to that store, and you want to have them want you to be a good customer. Because to them, it's, you know, better business, and they get to stay around, and they get to keep being a store that plays Magic.
Usually stores start because people like the game, and so that's what they want to do. And a lot of times, like, you know, I've known LGSs where they'll get to know you to the point where you'll come in and they'll be like, hey, this card just came in. You might want it for your deck, and they'll show it to you, and you never even would have known. And they'll look out for you if you, you can.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been in communities that were small enough. In LA, that doesn't happen as often because there's millions of people.
It's a big
here.
City, yeah.
Yeah, but
even then, like, I still know some employees of on name basis at certain stores, so.
So yeah, it can totally happen, and that's, again, it's just community building.
Yeah. Finally, don't buy something at its height. So learn about the rotation cycle. Cards are going to be worth the most when they're super wanted in a format like Modern or Standard, and that's why you'll see some cards that may be great for EDH be super expensive because they're played in another format and they're a hot card. Don't buy the card if it's super hyped, because you almost have a 100% chance of a new card coming out is going to go down in price before it goes up. I think it's going to hit a peak and it's always going to fall, and I think you're always better off waiting for it to go down unless you are very early in catching it.
Yeah, I think, well, it's different for different formats. So Standard has a rotation cycle. I guess we should talk about the rotation cycle really quick. Not all EDH players know about it. A lot of you probably do, so just bear with us. Standard's actually moving to a new rotation cycle where there will be three blocks at a time that are legal in Standard, and there will all be two set blocks.
Now, before, it was like a 3-1-3 kind of thing.
Yeah, and sometimes it would be 3-2-3. There'd be two core sets for a second, for a hot minute, and two full blocks of three.
It's so kind of messy.
Yeah, now it's going to be 2-2-2, and so it'll either be five total sets or six total sets. So we're in the middle of this weird switchover, but as soon as Battle for Zendikar comes out, then Theros block is gone.
It's going to be the new format.
So there'll be all the Khans block, Magic Origins, and Battle for Zendikar.
And the next set.
And then the next set, the second half of Battle for Zendikar, whatever that's called, will come out. And then after that, Khans and Fate Reforged will fall off.
And that will be the final three-block set in the new standard, right?
No, because Dragons of Darkir and Magic Origins are actually a two-block set for rotation purposes.
Wow.
Which is really confusing.
Jeez.
So basically go read about the standards rotation cycle, because what happens is, as soon as, like, coming up here, Theros is about to fall off.
Mm-hmm.
And so Theros won't be legal in standard. So all the cards that are useful in standard decks right now
from that block
will be worth way less as soon as Theros is not legal in standard, because the only cards in Theros that'll still be good are cards that are playable in modern or legacy, which there aren't very many.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, even the ones that are playable in modern or legacy, they'll still drop, because there just won't be the demand for them in those two other formats that there was in standard, because standard is far and away more popular than the other formats. So it's a supply and demand issue. So if you learn about rotation cycle, you can hit these moments where, for us, for EDH, it doesn't matter because we don't rotate. So
thank goodness.
Yeah. So it's about to happen with Theros, where Theros is going to fall off standard rotation. And then that's the time to pick up the Theros cards.
Yeah. Because and very importantly, the gods, actually.
Yep.
I think that's a great time to get stuff like Purphoros and all those gods. I think they'll see their all-time lows as soon as Theros drops off.
Yeah. Because people literally just go to the store and they just dump all their Theros block stuff, and they try and buy into the whatever the new set that came out that's going to be legal in standard is.
Yeah,
and
so the stores just that's how they have to do it.
Yeah, and so that's standard. What we call, that's a moment when the supply is really high and the demand is really low. And if you're a buyer, that's what you want. You want high supply, low demand. So that's a way to sort of pick your moment and buy the same card that you would have bought 2 months later or maybe 2 months before, and you just hit this moment where it's not at a peak, it's at a valley. Mm-hmm. So, and then modern has sort of a season. So we're about to come up on Modern season, because Masters of Modern, I was going to say Masters of Modern 2, but it's actually Masters of Modern 2015.
Modern Masters 2015.
Oh, yeah.
We're just
Masters of Modern is the podcast
that
Alex and Ben are on that you should totally listen to, because it's about modern and competitive Magic. But Modern Masters is the set of cards. So Modern Masters 2015 is about to come out, and that's going to kick off a season of some modern events. So there'll be modern Sealed, there'll be modern Pro Tour, there'll be modern, a bunch of modern
and
tournaments.
And this affects us much more than standard.
Well, it's just to pay attention to what's legal in modern, which is every set with the new border. Our buddy Gavin Verhey actually sort of invented this format. But you learn about what's in modern.
He definitely was the inspiration for the new modern.
Yeah, so learn about what's in modern, and then do not buy it when modern's in season, because that's the time when everyone's playing those decks, and so those cards are at the most possible demand.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to want to buy modern cards, say 6 months ago,
that's
at the point when there were no modern events. In fact, everyone was complaining, like, "Where's the modern events?"
Yeah.
Well, those cards weren't in demand at all because no one was buying, because no one needed to play them. So it can get complicated, but if you do a little research, you can really find these deals and these moments where the same cards are just a lot less or a lot more, depending on what's in season, what's legal in what format. This is another place where if you don't have a ton of money, but you have some time, you can research and you can turn that time into equity.
Yep.
Yeah.
A little research goes a long way. So for instance, if you wanted to buy Elspeth, Sun's Champion recently, you should have waited for the dual deck to come out, because Wizards, every time they have a set, they like to print these things called dual decks, which are two cards sort of verse each other in themed decks, and they're often reprints of cards that are popular in standard. And if you want a sweet card in standard for your deck and you don't want to pay a higher price for it, that's like, you want to just keep an eye out for these kind of things, because Wizards does things on the schedule. You know, the same kind of products, clash packs, dual decks, come out with every set, and so they'll always have stuff that might interest you.
Speaking of the Modern Masters 2015 set that's going to be coming out in May, that's what GP Vegas is. Now would not be a good time to be buying a bunch of cards that may or may not appear in that set.
Yes, because and that's very important to note right now. Yeah,
those prices are going to drop precipitously on anything that's at least below mythic rarity.
Yep. Tarmogoyfs so, will mostly stay at about the same price.
They might come down a little, but they might go up. They went up last time.
That's
you know?
Insane.
But anything that like doubling season, now is probably, I don't know that they'll reprint it. I'm not making predictions on that. It's just like, is it worth it? Because last time it was in the set and it dropped a lot and it's climbed back up. So now's not the time to buy it. Yeah. Unless you just really want it for that deck tomorrow, you know. Otherwise, I would wait and see what's in Modern Masters 2015.
Okay, Primal Vigor instead, just as good.
Yeah, so just find those cards that aren't in Modern and maybe buy those right now. But Modern's just anything that's legal in Modern, I just don't know right now that investing in anything expensive that's legal in Modern is a good idea right now.
It's the danger zone.
Yeah.
Other small ways to save before we wrap this mini topic up is buying everything near mint is going to cost you. And it just depends on your mentality towards that kind of thing. If you don't care, then you can save like $3 on a card just by getting heavily played or whatever. And over a course of like 10 cards, you're saving like $30. It's a huge difference.
And really, like on a card that is less than $5, does it matter if it's near mint or not? Like that card's not valuable.
Yeah.
Like I get it if you're buying a dual land, an old school dual land, and you want it to be near mint over because that card's going to hold its value.
Right.
And you might be able to turn it into, you know, it's going to increase in value. But yeah, a $3 card is likely to be a $3 card in 5 years. So, or worse. So why are you worried about, you know, what its value is?
Yeah, precisely. And finally, you guys have the power of the internet. So go ahead and use it. Go listen to our friend Jason Ault over on the Brainstorm Brewery podcast. They have very informative podcasts about just finance in general. There's a subreddit on Reddit for MTG Finance. So there's also MTG Market Watch, which is sort of the more publicly run one. Finance is a little more restrictive, but there's tons
there's
of articles.
Quiet speculation.
Yeah, lots of people speculate and talk about this sort of stuff. So you can go on, and it's fun to actually kind of read and see what people are saying and find out the reasoning behind specs and stuff.
I listen to Brainstorm Brewery every week, and I don't even deal that much with finance, but it's very interesting to just learn about how the world of finance works.
Yeah.
And you know, even if you don't buy cards that often, when you do, at least you have peace of mind that you're doing it in the correct manner, or at least the best manner possible for you.
Yeah, correct. I agree with you there.
One last tip Jason did give us, because Jason was on our show. If you haven't checked that out.
That was a really fun episode.
Yeah, he was on our show late last year in December. And the one big tip he sort of gave EDH players was just maybe double your orders when you're ordering cards. Because if you want a card for your deck, it must be pretty good in EDH, and somebody else will probably want it. So that's a decent way to sort of just spec on cards once in a while where you're like, this card's really good. I'm going to buy, I need two for my decks. Maybe I'm just going to buy four and I'll have two because at some point somebody else will want one of these.
Yep. That's a good point. And Jason had a scope on Primal Vigor, which was it's kind of like doubling season. And he was talking about it back when it was like $5. It's up to $8 now. So
yep.
The guy knows
what's
his
stuff. Dictate of Erebos, because I remember he mentioned that.
Oh, that's right. I have to look it up. But I'm sure they're climbing because these are good cards. Like Dictate of Erebos is what Grave Pact is, but with a lot more upside.
And it hasn't
rotated
out yet. It'll probably go up when that set's not in print anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that was a really good spec of his. I think he said he bought like 1,000 of them or something.
Jeez, for how much?
50 cents or something.
Oh, well, their mid's like hanging out at 75. So if you're buying that many, you're definitely going to be making some moolah off of it. All right. So our last section for today for the trading up episode is that now that you've got the card in your hand, it's time to put it into the deck. And there are other cards now that are floating around that are no longer in decks, and those cards are very sad. And so our final point is what to do with old cards. Don't burn them.
Unless they're Kolaghan. Kamol. Dang it.
Oh, gosh.
I said the name.
She must not be named.
Eli, cut that out. Just kidding, Eli. Just leave it. It's fine.
So we have a lot of old cards that are just no longer in decks. And the first main thing is just put them in another deck. That's the number one easy answer. If you don't have that luxury, then there are other ways. But like if you have, you know, you can make your card work if you really like that card, if it's a pet card. Like there's another legendary commander out there that will suit you very well.
I do. Do you do this? I don't know if you do, but I take all the cards that sort of were close to making the cut in any deck and I have a separate box. And those are just all the cards that were like on the fringe of playable in a deck. And that means they'll probably be playable in something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I've separated out into just colors and just like, so sometimes I'll just have a bunch of like, you know, commons that I need a lot of in a certain deck and they'll just be all in that color. So like, it's nice to have these depositories so you can like look through and be like, oh, this staple I need for this or whatever.
Right.
And another route is to sell them. And this is a lot of work in general.
It is.
It's more daunting than it seems. Don't buy a car because you're like, I'm going to sell it eventually. I actually have a history of doing this with all my cards. Every single big hobby I've gotten into, I've always gotten out of.
Sold out all at once?
Yeah. Well, World of Warcraft, I mean, I was like 19, obsessed with the game, and I played it. And then the next expansion was coming out, and I was like, now I'm in college, and I just don't have the interest anymore. Sell my account. Got $700 for it.
Nice. I sold my EverQuest account for $900.
Nice. Well, I calculated it out. I think Freddie calculated it out. Yeah. I was making something like 25 cents an hour.
Probably less. That's pretty good, actually.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I was making as much as
I'm the exact opposite of you, except for the EverQuest thing. I never sell out of anything. So I have a Warcraft account sitting there with like 12 million gold on it right now.
Of course, you would also have the account that just knew how to run the auction system left and right and up and down. I was always the guy that was just like, oh, fine, I'll pay this outrageous price for this item.
I was the one selling it to you.
Yeah, that's really funny. But yeah, I played another card game called Magi Nation when I was a kid, and I sold out of that because the company went out of business. I don't think Magic's going anywhere anytime soon.
I think you're good. I think you're fine.
Anyway, so there are a few routes to selling cards. You can eBay them, you can go to your LGS, or you can use buy lists. Unless you're getting rid of a ton of cards, I wouldn't recommend buy lists because they generally offer much less prices because they're buying in bulk. So unless you're like a guy like Jason that's specking on a ton of cards, don't do buy lists in general, I think. Unless you just want to get rid of a card fast and not have to worry about the selling each individual one.
Or sometimes I would say it's okay if you're getting that 30% store credit thing or something like that. In which case, that'll even out the buy list gap.
Yeah, and you can find some good deals. Again, like your LGS is there to help, you know, make a cool transaction that you're both happy with. And eBay is another option, but I don't think it's that great because there's a lot.
Such a pain.
Yeah, I appreciate people for selling cards on eBay. I do not want to sell them myself because you need to create like a mini website that people go to that will draw in bids. Like otherwise, your card's not going to sell successfully.
And there's fees and
all this. Tons of fees,
What a headache.
Yeah, and also, there could be potential issues when you ship a card to someone else and they'll complain that wasn't in mint condition. And in general, eBay almost always sides with the buyer.
Right.
So the seller is not on eBay's like, good, like, don't worry, I got your back side.
Well, because they're always going to have sellers, but if they don't have buyers, they're done.
Exactly. And I still think your LGS is your best bet in the close vicinity if you want to get rid of something the same day. Because you can either trade with someone there, or you can just sell to the store for cash, store credit, or just outright cash sometimes.
Yep.
And also, if you have like large boxes of commons and uncommons, you can sell them for a pretty fair price per card because stores usually are looking to pick up that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we already talked about this, but you can also trade your cards. Your LGS is also a place to trade.
It's a great place for that. I mean, that's where you're going to find players that you wouldn't otherwise normally be in contact with.
Because,
you know, after a while, you've seen all your friends' cards.
Yeah.
And so there's only so much trading that can happen. But that's the way to sort of get an influx of cards you haven't seen from a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good way.
Yeah. And I think trading 5 to 10 okay to mediocre cards for 1 to 2 good cards is completely worth it.
Yeah, totally. I think that's what you want to do.
That's the essence of trading up.
It's harder to do, but yeah, if you can trade, you know, 10 cards worth $2 for one $20 card, in general, you want to do that because it's way harder to get rid of a bunch of $2 cards than it is to get rid of one $20 card, you know?
Yeah. And even if like one of those $2 cards becomes more expensive in the long run, you still have more value for that single card than you do in that entire batch of 10.
Yeah.
Another great thing you can just do is just give them to a friend because there are people that want to get into Commander that play Magic already, and giving someone, you know, ways to make a free deck around this new legendary creature they pulled in the draft, or just giving them some stuff that you aren't going to use and aren't interested in trying to go sell for however much you're going to get for it. And you're also going to build someone that you're going to, you know, play with. So it's a lot of fun to gift people cards.
Yeah, I mean, I know you do this, and I do this a lot too, which is at like pre-releases or something. You take out like the two rares you want, and then I just find some kid and be like, "Hey, you want all these?"
Yeah, I always leave my comments and uncomments and random rares that I want.
And people are you can usually tell which people will be excited to get like just a bunch of random cards.
I would have been so stoked if I was kid and got that.
Oh yeah, you just find the closest like 12 to 8 year old and be like, "Hey, you want all these?" And you're building your community when you do that. It's the same thing as building your LGS.
Yeah, and that kid will appreciate it for a long time because it means a lot. All right, and finally, there's GP Vegas. This isn't actually a category. This is
it's big enough to be its own category.
There are going to be people everywhere at this event with trade binders and vendors looking to get cards, sell cards, buy the cards you open in your packs as soon as you get them, that foil, I don't know, Elish Norn, because I think that's going to happen. And this is your chance to also offload a ton of stuff that you don't want to use anymore and replace it with some new awesome stuff. This is like the perfect place to do it. The only thing is you got to be safe. There's a lot of cards floating around, and each of those binders is worth a lot of money. Do not go anywhere where you're not within. You should be holding your cards at all time. You should be in contact with them. Don't let it slip out of your attention.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. GP Vegas is just going to be the mecca. It's going to be the biggest Magic event that the world's kind of ever like seen. And it's there's a million reasons to go, and this is just another one of them. But I think you're right. Like, yeah, you're going to have to be careful. There's going to be they're saying that a lot of the side events are going to sell out.
Yeah, that's insane, because usually they don't. And this is, again, a limited print run with Modern Masters, and it's shaping up to be the biggest face-to-face event. It is, I think, already.
It's going to be the biggest face-to-face gaming event in the history of the world.
Yeah.
This whole episode has just been an excuse to tell people to go to GP Vegas.
It's true,
we want to hang out with y'all.
I'm going to be there with my trade binders. We're definitely going to do some kind of meetup and outside of the main event.
Hell yeah.
And it'll be fun. I'd love to see what you guys all have to offer. It's going to be so great, you know, just going to restaurants after and, you know, seeing people that you've been playing with. And just, like, having all these people around is going to be a lot of fun. All right, well, let's move on to the end step. That has been the episode of Trading Up, making the best out of your cards and resources. There's so much more to cover, and there will always be new things that I learn as I procure cards and tips about how to trade up and how to, you know, find good value for what you're trying to do and have both parties be happy. But we'll save that for another episode. Let's move on to the end step.
The end step, where we talk about something usually outside of the world of Magic. This one's not going to be, although it will sort of be.
It's sort of be, yeah. So it is a Magic thing, but the larger scope of it is that it's an important sort of just life thing. Gabby Spartz, who is a, you should just look her up. I'll have a link about some of the stuff she's done. She's really cool. Wrote an article called Six Things You Can Do to Get More Women Into Magic. And it's a well-written article. There's a lot of common sense stuff in there that I think someone commented, she's going actually on, I think Channel Fireball tonight to talk about the article, because there's been a ton of controversy, and the top comment on that Reddit thread is my favorite, which is, it's sad that this is controversial.
Yeah,
and I completely agree with that.
It's funny because I was like, controversial?
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, if you read some of the comments,
anything about women in gaming
right
now,
the comment section
is,
by the way, but if you do, it's lame. Yeah, this has sort of been a hot button topic across gaming in general, from Gamergate all the way to here. And the big thing in the case of Magic is that we all play a role in being a part of a community. It's the same way that you play a role in being a part of your family and in being a part of your friend group and in being part of your high school. You represent what you participate in actively, and it's all aspects of Magic. So in general, just I would say one of the easy pitfalls to fall into when sort of thinking about the, like, oh, right, I'm going to work towards equality and stuff, is that you sort of turn it into a white knight kind of thing, where you become a hero of sorts, in this case to the feminine kind, for standing up for their rights and whatever. It's actually,
it's like that great quote about the movie The Help. I forgot who said it, but somebody was like, oh, yeah, another white people solve racism movie.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the thing. It's like, being a good person isn't a heroic thing. It's just the right thing to do. You're a human. Women are humans. We're all humans. It's just about being a decent human being. And I haven't showered in 4 days, so I'll be off now. That's about it.
I think, you know, we have a responsibility as Magic players, but also as gamers, you know, to create...
We're building our own future. Like, you guys
to create
that,
a welcoming atmosphere for, you know, all players, anybody who wants to play the game. And there shouldn't be a situation created where anybody feels like they're not welcome to play whatever game that you're playing. And so if you see those situations happen, then yeah, it's incumbent upon you to do something about it, to say something, and also to be welcoming, to be the person that, you know, makes the game fun for that even above winning, above anything else, is important. Because if we're not bringing new people into the game, whoever they are, you know,
you're just slowly dooming your own hobby to eventually die out.
Yeah,
it's kind of sad.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really a responsibility that we all have, and
My favorite award when I was growing up was the Spirit of the Game Award, which we always gave out after each game, because if someone was like, if like there was just this one player on the other team that lost badly, but he was just in it, he was having fun, he was cracking jokes, like that guy won the Spirit of the Game because he's just, or she is just the coolest person on the field.
Well, I don't know if you've heard this, Jimmy, but it's all about the game.
It's all about the game. At the end of the day, it's Dean, all about Ernie, the game. Calhoun. All right, so cleanup phase. Tell your friends about the show. If you guys have any new friends coming into Commander, I met some cool people at MTG Deals when I was playing a draft there, and the guy just bought his Commander deck, and he was looking through the cards. I could see all the cogs going. It was awesome. I was like, hey, you should listen to the Command Cast.
Why'd you put that voice on when you said that?
Well, this I was nervous because I was like, how do I advertise myself without coming off as pretentious?
That's true. It's hard to walk up to somebody and go, hey, listen to the show I do. I'm really smart.
I will teach you things you never knew, boy. I should have told him we reviewed the deck that he bought, but it was actually Commander 2013, so we didn't cover that one. But I was super excited to see like the spark ignite, his right. Planeswalker spark, Josh.
You didn't dream crush him out of the format?
I didn't. I actually took his card.
Did you tuck his general and dream crush
no,
him out?
No, but I did take his big oversized foil, but he didn't seem to care because it's a giant oversized foil.
So he already knows that that's worthless.
Pretty much.
Well, he's a step ahead.
Yeah, so tell your friends about the show if they don't know about it. It would make a huge difference to us.
iTunes reviews.
Yes, yes, please. And a shout out to our sister podcast, The Masters of Modern. You can find them online at Twitter, at the MMCast. They talk about all things modern, and they're definitely... I mean, Kessler has been like 5 out of 5 on his predictions. The guy knows what he's talking about. And Ben is awesome, too. Like, they're both great co-hosts for each other. And it's always fun to see what they predict is coming because they're both pretty spot on.
They did a prediction episode really recently. And it's similar to what we were talking about earlier as far as what might be coming out in the Modern Masters set. So probably a good listen if you're thinking about buying anything. At least you'll get some expert thoughts on it.
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. We got another episode coming on Thursday where we're going to talk about Josh's Tim deck.
Oh, I'm excited to talk about that
one. Yeah, the Xur the Enchanter deck. It's a tapper deck, and it is...
No, Prodigal Sorcerer.
Prodigal Sorcerer. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, Xur is the... I don't know. That's the copy of Prodigal.
That's right. It is kind of a nightmare to play against, I'll say this much, but it is a lot of fun to play itself. So we'll talk about that next time.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, all right. We'll see you next time.
Peace.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.